So we're in 1 Samuel 21, and today we're beginning a section of 1 Samuel in which David is in exile from Israel. That's what these next few chapters chronicle. David has become a wanted man, and we've been seeing that develop over the last few studies, and now it's gone full-blown, and you know, there's figuratively a price on his head, you know, if, as it were. Scholars place David at being 20 years old when all this starts. That he, as of this chapter and chapter 21, he's 20 years old as he's going out and under this exile. And he's going to be on the run for 10 years. It's when he is 30 in 2 Samuel 5, verse 4, that he is coronated, you know, formally as king of Israel. That's in 2 Samuel 5. So 10 years of being on the run, you can imagine that would be pretty intense. When we think about his youthfulness here, also being 20 years old, it's going to help us maybe to give him a little bit of break here as we see him make some bad choices in our chapters today. Make some good ones too, and make some bad choices as well. Because first thing we see, and what's going to be prevalent in this first chapter, is that in his troubles, he's not really seeking God's guidance. He's just kind of going with it, you know, just sort of doing what, you know, what he thinks he should. And as a result, the first mistake that we see him make is that he puts other people at risk. We'll see that in chapter 21, verse 1. Let's go ahead and read there. It says, "Then David came to Nob, to Ahimelech the priest. And Ahimelech came trembling to meet David and said to him, 'Why are you alone and no one with you?' David said to Ahimelech the priest, 'The king has commissioned me with the matter and has said to me, let no one know anything about the matter on which I am sending you and with which I have commissioned you, and I have directed the young man to a certain place. Now, therefore, what do you have on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread or whatever can be found.' The priest answered David and said, 'There is no ordinary bread on hand, but there is consecrated bread, if only the young men have kept themselves from women.' David answered the priest and said to him, 'Surely women have been kept from us as previously, when I set out and the vessels of the young men were holy, though it was an ordinary journey. How much more than today will their vessels be holy?' So the priest gave him consecrated bread, for there was no bread, but the bread of the presence, which was removed from before the Lord, in order to put hot bread in its place when it was taken away. Now one of the servants of Saul was there that day, detained before the Lord, and his name was Doeg the Edomite, the chief of Saul's shepherds. David said to Ahimelech, 'Now is there not a spear or a sword on hand? For I brought neither my sword nor my weapons with me, because the king's matter was urgent.' Then the priest said, 'The sword of Goliath the Philistine, whom you killed in the valley of Elah, behold, it is wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod. If you would take it for yourself, take it, for there is no other except it here.' And David said, 'There is none like it. Give it to me.'" And so David, fleeing for his life now, he's gone to Nob. And Nob is, we find out, where the tabernacle is. So that's where the priests are. They're all there in this city, Nob. Now, normally this would be a good thing. You know, when we have trouble, it's good for us to go amongst God's people, you know, to gather together. And so that is a wise principle of seeking godly people in trouble. But unfortunately, in this case, it wasn't a real good idea for David, because he has a murderous king on his trail. You know, and so he's, wherever he goes, he's putting people at risk. And the high priest kind of recognizes this. You know, he's obviously scared to see David all by himself coming to him. I mean, David is obviously out of sorts here. I mean, he's a warrior. We know that of David. He's a warrior, but he's traveling without any of his weapons. That's unusual that he would leave without those things. He's a leader. He's a military leader, and yet he's traveling all by himself. That's also a red flag. And then finally, he is a royal official, you know, son-in-law of the king, and he's begging for food. This is another indication something is really wrong about this journey David's on. It seems pretty clear that he had to move, you know, really quickly without any planning. And so David, you know, hatches the story, kind of plays it off as though he's on top secret business. You know, it was so urgent, he couldn't do anything, and he just had to leave with just the clothes on his back. And he says, well, I'm going to rendezvous with these other men. You know, that's why they're not with me now, but I'm going to rendezvous with them. Now, that actually seems to be true, because when Jesus talks about this same account in Matthew and in Luke, he talks about this. He mentions about David and his companions eating this bread. And so it does look like David was going to meet up with some people potentially here. So he wasn't bluffing about that. But the rest of this is a lie that he puts together. And it seems like it was an effort to protect the priest in all this. You know, we talk a lot today about people having deniability. You know, if they don't know the whole story, they can deny. You know, I didn't really know about it. And that seems to be the ploy that David is making here, that I'm going to give the priest some deniability by lying to him and not telling him what's really going on. Well, unfortunately, as we read more in our verses today, we're going to see that is not successful for the priest. It doesn't work as a defense against this king. And so David is not really thinking clearly here, and he puts the priest now at peril, not just himself. And, you know, sometimes when we are following God's will, other people, you know, are at risk in that, or it does cost other people something. But this is always a choice that they should make. You know, we shouldn't make it for them. This should have been something that he let the priest know, you know, this is dangerous for me to be here. You know, let him put his own life in his own hands and not David, you know, deceive him like this and then place him in this position. I mean, it's always easy for us to look at someone else's sacrifice and think, that's not that much. You know, this seems like a small, you know, risk for them or whatever. But what about when we're the one making it, right? I mean, we should always follow the golden rule here. We would want to be able to seek God about whether or not this is a risk I should take. And so certainly other people would want to do the same. Certainly the priests would have wanted to do the same, as we're going to read on further. But in this whole exchange that David has here with the priest, he asks for food. And the priest tells him that all they have is the bread of the presence. But this bread they can only have if the men have been kept from women. And why, you know, why does he say that? Well, it basically means that they're ritually clean is what it means. They need to be ritually clean in order to partake of this bread. This bread is elsewhere called the consecrated bread or the show bread or the sacred bread. These are all synonyms for this bread of the presence. And this bread, each Sabbath, was replaced with fresh bread there in the tabernacle. The old bread then, last week's bread, you know, was then eaten by the priests. And traditionally they would eat it right there in the tabernacle. So clearly they would have been ritually clean in order to eat this bread. So that we see why they want David and his companions to be clean also. And Jesus reminded us of this account of David eating this bread. I made mention of it earlier. Let me read now from Matthew 12. Matthew 12, verse 3, speaking of Jesus, it says, but he said to them, have you not read what David did when he became hungry, he and his companions, how he entered the house of God and they ate the consecrated bread, which was not lawful for him to eat, nor for those with him, but for the priests alone. And so the Bible isn't clear on why this bread was called the bread of the presence. But clearly it's a reminder of God's presence in some way. You think, of course, of God's presence there with the Ark of the Covenant and all of this. One popular understanding of the purpose of the bread was that it was to symbolize how God's presence is what we depend upon. And certainly the priests depended upon this bread, you know, as part of their food that they were to eat. And we know today as believers, anyone who is a believer, that God's presence is our daily bread. It's what we need more than anything else. And so David and his companions certainly would need to depend on God to protect them from Saul. And so just like we need the presence of God, they needed God's protection, his presence in their lives to protect them. And that's such a good thing for us to remember, that when life is overwhelming to us, you know, God is the one that can calm our storms. Or when our life doesn't make sense to us, he's the one who can bring peace into that situation. And when we have those burdens that are too heavy, God is the one who is strong enough to carry those for us. The common denominator in all this is that we need God's presence with us. Now, God is omnipresent, and so that means that He is always there. There's never been a moment in our lives that God wasn't there. But what needs to happen is we need to acknowledge that He's there. We need to recognize that He's there. And that's what makes all the difference. When we realize that God is here with me, I'm not in this all alone. You know, and if God is with us, who can stand against us, as the verse says? Well, back to this context in 1 Samuel 21, though, the fact that this bread of the presence was the only food that the priests had actually is indicative of the bad state that Israel is in at this point in time. Because the priests were to receive their food through the tithes of the people. People were supposed to bring food to the tabernacle, and so the priests had sustenance. And so the fact that all they have was this bread, that's really bad. They should have had a lot of food there for them to live off of, but they didn't. All they had was this bread. And so that tells us spiritually things weren't right in Israel. People weren't really obeying the law as they were supposed to. But finally, David then asks for a weapon from the priest. That's kind of interesting, you know. Do you got any weapons around here, you know, the tabernacle? I mean, you know, you come to the church today, you don't go, you got any weapons in here? You know, it's not really a normal thing there. It's not a stockpile, you know, for weapons. But in this case, there was a weapon there. And it's not mentioned why Goliath's sword was there at the tabernacle. We assume really it was kind of a trophy for the nation, you know, that, hey, you know, this not only was a defeat that God used David for, this was a defeat for the whole nation of Israel. They defeated the Philistines that day. And so a sort of a trophy, this was brought back there to commemorate what God had done, you know, how God had defeated this giant. And so in God's providence, that sword is there now for David. And David gladly accepts this huge sword. Remember, it was extra large because it was for this extra large person. And this will be the second time that he's wielded it. Yeah, he wielded it on that first day, but now he'll carry it again. And let me suggest, though, that David knew that sword was there. Let me suggest that he knew that sword was there. Why do I say that? Well, when David won that sword back in 1 Samuel 17, it told us that he took that sword and put it in his own tent. And so he was keeping that sword. And so it seems likely that sometime after that, he's the one who decided, you know, I should give this to the priests so all of Israel can celebrate this victory. It seems that that's probably what happened. I don't think the priest went over there and swiped it out of his tent. You know, I don't think anyone stole it from David after that. I think he decided to give it to him. So he knew that was there. And so when he came and asked, you guys got any weapons? He kind of knew there was this sword there that would really be helpful to him now. But now we're going to see a second mistake that David is falling into here is that we don't really see him seeking the Lord yet in these verses. Let's read from chapter 21, verse 10, 1 Samuel 21, 10. It says, then David arose and fled that day from Saul and went to Achish, king of Gath. But the servants of Achish said to him, is this not David, the king of the land? Did they not sing of this one as they danced, saying, Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s? David took these words to heart and greatly feared Achish, king of Gath. So he disguised his sanity before them and acted insanely in their hands, and scribbled on the doors of the gate, and let his saliva run down into his beard. Then Achish said to his servants, behold, you see the man behaving as a madman. Why do you bring him to me? Do I lack madmen, that you have brought this one to act the madman in my presence? Shall this one come into my house? And so David here, like I said, is kind of making himself a fool. We see that as I read that. The first thing we know is that he flees to what to us seems like the most unlikely place in all the world he would go to. He goes to the Philistines. He goes to the land of the Philistines. These are the ones he's been defeating in battle these last couple of chapters we've been reading about, you know. So it's kind of strange. He's going to his enemy now. And then he goes specifically to Gath. And Gath was the home of Goliath, whom he killed. And so now he's only going to Goliath's hometown. He's also taking Goliath's sword with him. Hey, remember this guy? I've got his sword here. Guy I killed that was probably related to some of you. You know, I'm the one that did that. But, you know, in David's defense, it is possible. Let me back up. First of all, Gath was the nearest Philistine city to Judah. And so it was the closest place to go where there was like civilization. And it seems likely that his goal in going there was he was hoping to hire himself out as a mercenary because he was a great warrior. And why do I say that? Well, because he actually does that in the future. In 1 Samuel 27, he returns again to Gath. And in that chapter, he does that very thing. He hires himself out as a mercenary to the people there. Now, the Philistines, though, as David comes in this time, they recognize him, or at least recognize his name. And, you know, David expected that he was kind of famous now because of, you know, things he had done. But they're not happy to see him. Instead of being like, hey, this is this great warrior, let's get him to work for us, they think they want vengeance on this guy is what they want. They want to put him to death now, the way he put Goliath to death. And they remember that song of the women, the song that, you know, they, and it's quoted here for us, that song that began all of David's problems, really. If you think about it, it was that song that created all this jealousy within Saul and started the whole nasty, you know, events that we've been watching the last couple of times have come together. And so when David sees all that, it causes him to fear. And so he decides, I'm just going to act like I'm crazy and, you know, they'll let me go. And that's what he decides. And he literally does that. He acts like he's lost his mind, does all these crazy behaviors so that they'll think he's just a nut, you know. And this isn't exactly what we'd expect to see in our hero, you know, that he acts like he's crazy. You know, we've all watched movies and read books. We expect him to pull out that sword and fight his way out of that room or something, you know, but no, he acts like he's crazy. And, you know, there's a reason that this may have been successful for him. We see the strategy worked. It did save his life. And that's because, you know, commentators suggest that, you know, David acting this way possibly convinced him it wasn't really David at all. That this was just some crazy guy claiming to be David. Because if you think about it, I mean, this is way before the time that the photograph was invented. And so there's a good chance no one in that room had ever actually seen David. You know, or seen him close enough to really recognize him. And so he acts like he's crazy. Yo, I'm David. And he's acting all nuts. You're like, this isn't David. This is some crazy guy, you know, claiming to be him. We don't know how he probably stole the sword. You know, that's how I got the sword. And so it works. You know, David, you know, gets out of the situation. And it's interesting, though, as we read that, I mean, we look at that and we see how David really, you know, worked his way out to save his own skin. But David's recollection of the events is a little bit different as we read about it. I'm going to read from Psalm 56. Psalm 56 is what he wrote in regard to his being arrested by the Philistines. The text doesn't really tell us that he was arrested, but apparently he was actually arrested by them. You know, it wasn't like he walked in there, you know, willingly. They actually arrested him when they saw him. Psalm 56 verse 8 says, David wrote, "You have taken account of my wanderings. Put my tears in your bottle. Are they not in your book?" That was Psalm 56, 8. I think that's such an awesome passage. I mean, how much meaning these words had for David. You know, think about his wanderings. He's fled to Nob, where he had to beg for bread. You know, he'd been living in the king's palace. Now he's begging for bread. Now he's off to Gath, where he had to fend for his life, you know, by this acting job he did, you know, to save his own skin. And yet he knew that in his trial, God was still there. His sojourn, as it were, was not hidden from God, but it was accounted by God. Like, God's keeping track of it. Yeah, I know what's going on. I know exactly what's happening to you. And in fact, his tears that he shed were not in vain, but this idea that God had bottled those tears is so awesome. What a picture of God's care for us. You know, you think about a time of grief or mourning or whatever that would evoke tears in us, and to think that God would bottle each one. You know, we don't count how many tears we shed, but God bottles them. These things are true of us today, you know, that God cares for us just like this. Our trials, when we go through our trials, we're not alone out there in the wilderness, though it may feel like it, and sometimes it does feel like it. But it's not true, because God is there with us. And your tears, your frustration, your anguish is just as precious to God as David's was. You know, David was, yeah, he was the king of Israel, but no more special than we are. You know, that God thinks of us in the same way as he did David. And so never forget that those wanderings that we go through at times, they're not in vain, especially for us today as Christians. They're not in vain. God is using those wanderings to perfect our faith. He's using it to sanctify us, to make us more like Jesus. Now, sometimes difficulties come into our life, and it's a corrective action of God. You know, we're beginning to stray, and so he brings a trial in to snap us back, you know, to help us get back on the right path. But, you know, there's a lot of times that difficulties come into our life, and it's not because we're doing anything wrong. In fact, it may be because we're doing everything right. And God just knows that this is a tool that I'm going to use in order to bring about that sanctification. For some reason, that growth can't happen other than going through some time of suffering like this. And so be encouraged that those times are not in vain, and God is there. But David also wrote Psalm 34 as a response to all these events we've been reading about. And this is after he has been set free from the king's presence there. We read the account. We see David kind of saving his own skin. That's how we look at it. He acted like this and it worked and all that. But David saw it differently from Psalm 34, verse 4. Psalm 34, 4 says, "I sought the Lord and he answered me and delivered me from all my fears. They looked to him and were radiant, and their faces will never be ashamed. This poor man cried, and the Lord heard him and saved him out of all his troubles. The angel of the Lord encamps around those who fear him and rescues them." And so David sees his deliverance there as coming from God, not from himself. Even though David was acting and all that, he knows that really God is the one who delivered him. It wasn't himself. And this is how God works in our lives today too. Usually when God is working in our lives, it involves us in some way. We know, for example, that God provides the things we need so we can pay our bills and all of that. And yet most of us have had some work involved there. You know, we've gone to a job at some point anyways, and that's how God's provided for us. Or, you know, we thank him for providing the food that we have every day, but generally, we've done some shopping or we've done something so that we could acquire that food. And yet we know that God is the one who provided that. David knew, as we do, that all of our efforts will fail if God is not in it, if God is not there blessing it. And so even though God works through our hands at times, he is still the one working. And so we give him all the rightful praise and glory because it belongs to him. Well, so far as we've been reading, we've seen some mistakes that David's made here. But next we're going to see David showing some wisdom. Let's look at 1 Samuel 22, verse 1. "So David departed from there and escaped to the cave of Adullam. And when his brothers and all his father's household heard of it, they went down there to him. Everyone who was in distress and everyone who was in debt and everyone who was discontented gathered to him. And he became captain over them. Now there were about 400 men with him. And David went from there to Mizpah of Moab. And he said to the king of Moab, 'Please let my father and my mother come and stay with you until I know what God will do for me.' Then he left them with the king of Moab, and they stayed with him all the time that David was in the stronghold. The prophet Gad said to David, 'Do not stay in the stronghold. Depart and go into the land of Judah.' So David departed and went to the forest of Hereth." So David here, he has retreated from Philistia to the cave of Adullam. And this is sort of like in a wasteland between Philistia and Israel, from what we gather. It's about 10 miles southeast of Gath, and which puts it 15 miles away from Bethlehem, David's hometown. And there, David is joined then by this large group, including his family, his family comes to join him. And we read that and think, oh, that's so cool. His family is coming to encourage him. You know, as he's on the run, he's fearing for his life. They're coming to encourage him in that way. But, you know, actually, I think they were coming because they were afraid. They came there out of fear to come to David, where they felt they would be safer than they would be in Bethlehem. Because Saul, as you know, crazy as he's becoming, might easily take revenge out on David's family. You know, it's like, well, I can't get to him, but I can't get to them. They're, you know, in my backyard, as it were. Because even his brothers here apparently have left Saul's army to flee. They were in Saul's army previously, we saw. Remember that when we were reading about David and Goliath a couple weeks ago, that David's father was too old to go and check on his sons in battle. He couldn't leave, you know, his home to do that. But now he's going out to meet David in the wilderness, you know, 15 miles, which would be a long journey for someone, especially an elderly person in that time. And so David, you know, wisely takes his aging parents somewhere that they're going to be in a more comfortable and safe environment. He takes them to Moab. Remember that from Ruth chapter 4, verse 17, that Ruth is, or was, David's great-grandmother. That was his great-grandmother, Ruth, and she was a Moabitess. And so we reason that there was still a connection there in the family as a result, because great-grandma was from Moab, and so let's just take mom and dad over there where there's some safety and there's some connection. Because his parents obviously couldn't go back home. It wasn't going to be safe. But, you know, David is really roughing it, you know. He's staying in a cave. You know, I mean, this isn't really going to be easy on mom and dad either. And so, like a good son, he finds a place to take care of his parents here where they'll be safe. And it does say a lot about a person's character for how we care for the weak, or if we care for the weak. David's parents really couldn't do anything for him now, you know, if you think about it. But he cares for them because obviously that's the right thing to do. And it's sad in our culture today, you know, so often the weak are victimized. We think about unborn children are victimized in our nation because of, through, you know, abortion, through the tragic abortion industry. But even the sick and even often the elderly in some parts of the Western world are being victimized today through euthanasia, where someone is obviously in a weakened state of mind and are allowed to make a decision to have their life ended rather than continue to live the way they are. It's a tragic thing that's taking place. And so David here, as he's there at the cave, he has a bunch of other people join with him too, 400 men all together. And this is this disgruntled bunch that comes out to David here. These were those who no doubt wanted to see Saul's reign come to an end based on the various things it says that they were dealing with. And so they flock to David, who David's become the unwilling rival to Saul. He doesn't want to be Saul's rival. He's loyal to Saul. And yet here he finds himself this unwilling rival to the king. But what is the source of David's wisdom that we're now seeing? Well, I think in verse 5, we got our hint of that. As David is interacting with the prophet Gad has joined with David now. That's really cool. He's got a prophet in his company. And the prophet has a message for David, and that's go back to Judah. That's his message for him. David's been wandering all over, but he needs to get back to his own land, is what the prophet's telling him at this point. Now, Hereth, this forest, is not actually far from the cave at Adullam, which leads us to believe that David went to the cave of Adullam, and then he went to this place that was the stronghold, that was somewhere else. That's not real clear exactly where that was, but obviously outside of Judah. And so now David is being told to go back to Judah. And maybe that stronghold was vulnerable to attack. We don't know what was the deal, what was wrong with it. But clearly, God wanted him there in Judah. David already is showing proper submission to God through his prophet. I mean, it's been a long time since we've seen that in the book of 1 Samuel, because Saul never did get that right. You know, that, and that's ultimately what disqualified him as king, is he wouldn't submit to God. You know, God's like, hey, I got these prophets. They're going to give you guidance, you know. And he wouldn't follow. He'd follow in part, but not in full. And so he never would submit to God. And so David, though, is now being led by God. But unfortunately, his prior wanderings there, where he wasn't really making great decisions, are not going to be without consequences. Let's read from chapter 22, verse 6, 1 Samuel 22. Then Saul heard that David and the men who were with him had been discovered. Now Saul was sitting in Gibeah under the tamarisk tree on the height with his spear in his hand, and all his servants were standing around him. Saul said to his servants who stood around him, "Hear now, O Benjamites, will the son of Jesse also give to all of you fields and vineyards? Will he make you all commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds? For all of you have conspired against me, so that there is no one who discloses to me when my son makes a covenant with the son of Jesse. And there is none of you who is sorry for me or discloses to me that my son has stirred up my servant against me to lie in ambush as it is this day." Then Doeg the Edomite, who was standing by the servants of Saul, said, "I saw the son of Jesse coming to Nob, to Ahimelech the son of Ahitub. He inquired of the Lord for him, gave him provisions, and gave him the sword of Goliath, the Philistine." And so Saul hears about David's movements here, and he's troubled by it. He's convinced that David is laying in ambush for him, although we know that's exactly the opposite of what's happening. And Saul is sitting there in his hometown of Gibeah under this nice tree there with this spear, it says. And he wants to know why no one is letting me know what's going on here. You know, why is everyone being so silent about what's happening with David? Even amongst his own clan, he refers to them as the Benjamites, which he was of the clan of the Benjamites. And so he utters this challenge there, mixed with a lot of self-pity as we read it. You know, you can't miss that. And he's saying, do you think David's going to take good care of you? You know, when he becomes king, do you think he's going to take better care of you than I do? And it's actually a valid, you know, question or concern, because generally, you know, if someone else becomes king, you know, another tribe, another family, well, they're probably going to wipe out the family of their predecessor to make sure they don't rise up against them, you know. And so that's, you know, a good point that Saul is making. And generally, I mean, obviously David's not going to do that, but that's a valid concern of kings in general. Certainly wouldn't expect that new king to enrich the family of his, you know, former king. But interestingly, no one in his family speaks up. You know, they're all silent here. You know, he's even, you know, saying some bad things about Jonathan there. You know, that Jonathan is plotting against him, even though Jonathan has been, you know, very loyal as well. But when it came to, you know, what's right and saving the life of David, you know, God's true anointed, well, he did the right thing and helped David escape. It's only a servant, though, who speaks up now in answer to Saul's challenge. And maybe the people in his family didn't know anything. But Doeg the Edomite does know something, because he was there when all this took place. Now, why was Doeg there at the tabernacle when David showed up there? Well, it seems that Doeg was actually, you know, not just an Edomite or from Edom, but he was actually a proselyte to the Jewish faith. And so he was probably there, you know, bringing some offering or something like that to the temple. And that's why he had to be there at that time. And remember, Edom is, the people of Edom are actually the descendants of Jacob's brother Esau. That's where Edom comes from. And so Doeg actually gives a factual report of what he saw there. He seems to add something, though. He says that he inquired of the Lord. Not only did, you know, he give David a sword and all this and food, but he also inquired of the Lord for him. And our text didn't tell us that, but actually in verse 15, a little bit further, the priest agrees. Yeah, I did inquire of the Lord for David. And so Saul now is going to launch a full investigation into this situation. Let's read a little more. 1 Samuel 22, verse 11 says, "Then the king sent someone to summon Ahimelech the priest, the son of Ahitub, and all his father's household, the priests who were in Nob, and all of them came to the king. Saul said, "Listen now, son of Ahitub." And he answered, "Here I am, my lord." Saul then said to him, "Why have you and the son of Jesse conspired against me, in that you have given him bread and a sword, and have inquired of God for him, so that he would rise up against me by lying in ambush, as it is this day?" Then Ahimelech answered the king and said, "And who among all your servants is as faithful as David, even the king's son-in-law, who is captain over your guard and is honored in your house? Did I just begin to inquire of God for him today? Far be it from me. Do not let the king impute anything to his servant or to any of the household of my father, for your servant knows nothing at all of this whole affair." But the king said, "You shall surely die, Ahimelech, you and all your father's household." And the king said to the guards who were attending him, "Turn around and put the priests of the Lord to death, because their hand also is with David, and because they knew that he was fleeing and did not reveal it to me." But the servants of the king were not willing to put forth their hands to attack the priests of the Lord. Then the king said to Doeg, "You turn around and attack the priests." And Doeg the Edomite turned around and attacked the priests. And he killed that day 85 men who wore the linen ephod. And he struck Nob, the city of the priests, with the edge of the sword, both men and women, children and infants, also oxen, donkeys, and sheep. He struck with the edge of the sword. And so, really ugly account here that we're reading. I mean, Saul launches this investigation. He calls in, though, not just the accused, which would be Ahimelech. He calls in all the priests to come to this meeting, which was the first sign of trouble. You know, why did all of them need to come? And it's also an indication that Saul knew ahead of time what he was going to do here. It wasn't like he just impulsively said, "Kill them all," you know. He actually was planning on this. I mean, that's why he brought all of them in there. It seems more likely. And so he questions Ahimelech, but clearly he's not seeking answers, is he? I mean, he doesn't really want to hear what Ahimelech has to say. Ahimelech offers reasonable, truthful answers. Why wouldn't I help him? I mean, he's your son-in-law. He's the captain of your army. You know, he lives in your house. I mean, I have every reason to trust this man is doing what he says he told me he's doing. Ahimelech basically tells him as much. Ahimelech did was be deceived. You know, he was lied to and merely gave, you know, this man his own sword back and some bread. I mean, that's really what he's guilty of here. But Saul isn't interested in the truth. Saul is only interested in blood at this point. And, you know, we see a lot of hypocrisy like that in our world around us, even today, where someone is questioned, not really because the person asking the questions wants to understand the facts, but because they want to really assert their own opinion or even their own will, you know, upon this other person. Now, thankfully, in our society, we don't see these sort of things boiling over to murder like this. I mean, this is terrible. This murder happened. But still, it is an ugly sin even today. You know, when somebody makes a hypocritical investigation like this, you know, really they're just trying to hurt the other person. They're not really interested in what's true. Once again, though, Saul's family, to their credit, lets him down here. You know, he asked them, you know, to get involved here and to kill these innocent people. And he asked, you know, those others who are with him that are his servants, and they won't do it. You know, so basically it comes down to Doeg. And Doeg is willing to be his assassin here for him and does carry it out. And it's just such an ugly story. It's hard to read that without it turning your stomach, obviously. But as we see throughout Scripture, though, God preserves a remnant here. Let's read from chapter 22, verse 20, 1 Samuel 22. "But one son of Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, named Abiathar, escaped and fled after David. Abiathar told David and Saul, told David that Saul had killed the priests of the Lord. Then David said to Abiathar, 'I knew on that day when Doeg the Edomite was there that he would surely tell Saul, I have brought about the death of every person in your father's household. Stay with me. Do not be afraid, for he who seeks my life seeks your life, for you are safe with me." And so Abiathar is the lone priest who escapes from this slaughter to join with David. And now, as a result of this, as Abiathar comes to David, we see really the full model of leadership that God is intending now that there's a king. Now, he didn't want there to be a king. You know, him giving a king was a concession on God's part to the people of Israel. But now that there is a king, now we see the full model of leadership that God has for them. We see the king, that's David, is there. We see the prophets represented by Gad. And we see the priest, Abiathar. So we see prophet, priest, and king all there together. God's, you know, leadership package there for is ancient Israel. As opposed to Saul. Saul has none of these things. I mean, Saul is king, but really his kingdom has been taken away from him. God's already said, no, you're no longer it. You know, it's going to be David now. There's no prophets or priests with him. He is completely outside of God's will, alone in his sin. And so as we study today, we've seen David make some mistakes, unfortunately. But we've also seen some really great examples from David of things that we want to model in our own lives, we want to follow. The first thing is we saw that he did seek out the people of God in his trouble. Now, this went tragically bad for David, you know, because of this murderous king who was after him. But generally, that is the right thing for us to do when we have troubles, to seek out godly people, you know, to have around us, to discuss our problems with, to pray with, and all these kind of things. Secondly, we see that David cares for the weak. He cares for the weak throughout these chapters. He cares for his parents. He's taken in the outcasts of Israel who had nowhere to go. And now Abiathar the priest. David is caring for the weak, and that's always the right thing for us to do. That's God's will, that we care for those who are weak among us. Also, we see David listening to the Lord's direction through the prophet Gad. Clearly, something we always want to do as believers. We need to be following God's direction in our lives. And the final thing that we see David do that is also an example we want to follow is that he owns his own mistakes. When Abiathar comes to him here at the end of chapter 22 and tells him what has gone on, David accepts responsibility for the tragedy. He doesn't try and pawn it off and say, well, if the priest would have just said this, it would have been okay. You know, he doesn't say anything crazy like that. He accepts responsibility that I caused this. And that's something that often people don't want to do, is accept responsibility for their own mistakes. But that's a godly thing for us to do too. How different would our world be if only those four principles were followed by, you know, everyone in the world? Wouldn't it be awesome? You know, just those four things would be, it'd be amazing how much better our world would be if that would take place. Let's close in with a word of prayer. Lord Jesus, we're just so thankful for your word that you give to us. The New Testament tells us as examples that we can see in the Old Testament. And we see the example from David's life today. And Lord, we want to follow these things that he did that were right, Lord. We don't want to follow any of the mistakes he made, but we want to learn from those as well so that we don't follow into those. Because our sinful nature works the same way today as it did then. We're tempted by the same things. And so, Lord, we're just so thankful to you for your goodness in our lives, for your leading in our lives. We pray for that leading, that wisdom, that protection this week for all of us and all those who we're thinking of right now. In Jesus' name, amen.